Well, I guess there's only one thing to talk about this morning, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. We're going to look at it from Matthew chapter 28. So if you can have Matthew 28 open, page 1000 on the church Bibles, then it will help as we just proceed through this talk this morning. There may be some that have come with all kinds of things on your mind this morning, stuff filling your heart, maybe some deep sorrows, real sadnesses. And you're thinking, well, what's the resurrection got to do with me? Oh, why speak about an event that took place 2,000 years ago when at this point in my life I've got a panic about my health, I'm in deep anxiety about my finances, maybe there's a crisis in your marriage, or there's a real concern about your employment or your work. Maybe you've just got a frazzled mind and a worn-out body, or you're just plain simply worrying about the world's situation. So why consider the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Well, here is something that doesn't trivialize our present problems, but puts them into the perspective of eternity. We proclaim that Jesus Christ has conquered death itself. Our greatest enemy and our biggest fear has been dealt with. And once we've grasped that, then our outlook about everything changes. And on this Easter Sunday morning, we're going to consider the resurrection of Jesus Christ as it's told us from Matthew chapter 28. And we've got three different scenes in Matthew 28. The experience of the women, the deceit of the soldiers, and the commission of Christ. Think first, then, of the experience of the women in verses 1 to 10. We've already read this chapter, but note in verse 1, just by way of a side, really, before we get into these different scenes, in verse 1, you've got three reasons why we can be sure of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Three reasons why we know it's an historical event. First of all, names of witnesses are given. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. Now, they were well known when Matthew wrote his gospel. These people, Mary Magdalene, Magdalene's the place where she was from, the town where she was from, Magdala. And the other Mary is known as the Mary of the Apostles, James and Joseph. And here, these two Marys, they were still alive when Matthew's gospel was written. And it's as if Matthew was saying, go and ask them. They went to the tomb. They found it was empty. If you have any doubts that the tomb was empty, go and ask these ladies. I'll give you their names and their addresses. So there were witnesses for the empty tomb. What's more, the second thing you've got in verse 1 is the geographical accuracy. They went to the tomb. Say, okay, which tomb? Well, the tomb that they'd been to just before and they'd seen where Jesus Christ had been buried. So if you back up a little bit to Matthew chapter 27 and look at verse 56, we read this. Among the women who cared for Jesus were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Now Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So they knew exactly where that tomb was. They watched Jesus being buried. They watched the stone being rolled in front of the door, the opening. So on that Sunday morning, they go back to exactly the same spot. There's geographical accuracy. This is not in a land far, far away somewhere, but this is a place in Jerusalem. The third reason why we know that this is a historically accurate, not just the names and addresses of witnesses, and not just the fact that it was geographically accurate, but also there's just no fabrication of the story here. See, these ladies, they go to the tomb expecting to find a dead Jesus. What's more, throughout his 3 years of ministry, Jesus had told his disciples again and again that I'm going to rise on the third day. Now, you would expect that each one of those disciples would be at the tomb on the third day. But none of them are there. Why? Because none of them believed it would happen. So these women went to the tomb expecting to find a dead Jesus. The disciples were behind locked doors, not believing Jesus was alive. Now, if you were trying to get a religious movement going, if you were trying to get a people movement going to conquer the whole world, then you would put the kind of founders in a really good light. But this lot come across as a bunch of losers. They just don't believe it. So there's no fabrication here. Matthew is telling us as it is. He's not making things up. He's saying they didn't expect Jesus to be alive. Well, that by way of aside, historical accuracy. It's actually central, isn't it? It's not by way of aside. But by way of aside to this message this morning, because that's three scenes for us to look at. When these women eventually get to the tomb, what do they find? Well, verses 2, 3, and 4 tell us in a kind of flashback way what happened before the women got to the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone, sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him, they shook and became like dead men. These women see an open tomb, they see some guards that look like they're dead, and they see an awesome angel. This angel is awesome. He's not the cuddly cherub kind of angel. His appearance in verse 3 is like lightning. His clothes are as white as snow. He rolls back the tomb, as it's been said, not to let Jesus out, because he's already risen, but to let the disciples in. So they go into that tomb, and the body is not there. The angel is described, and the guards' reaction when they see the angels is before the women arrive now, then we see in verse 4 that the guards go into an altered state of consciousness. Is this a catatonic trance? Do they have a fit? Are they lying on the floor? Verse 4, they're so afraid they shake and become like dead men. These guards are terrified. Now these were Roman guards, and Roman guards and Roman soldiers were highly trained. Rome conquered the world with its military might. These guards had been in battles. They were highly trained not to be afraid of anything, not to run from a single soul. But they'd never come across anything like this before. This angel on this great mission to roll back the stone. And the guards shake and become like dead men. Now, when the women arrive at the tomb, they have this totally unexpected sight. They just didn't know this was going to face them. They encounter an open tomb, a dazzling angel, and some dead-like Roman soldiers. And then, in verse 5, the angel speaks to the women. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid." For I tell you, they were afraid. When they got there, they were afraid. What, dead-like soldiers on the ground, a mighty, living, magnificent angel sitting on the stone? You'd be afraid. They were afraid. But the angel puts them at ease. "Don't be afraid," he says. And the angel reassures them, and he announces to them the glorious truth of the resurrection. Verse 5, "Do not be afraid. I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen." Just as he said. You should remember, because he told you this again and again, just as he said. "Now, come and see the place where he lay, then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him. Now I have told you." So this angel, he gives a reassurance, he gives an invitation, come and see the place where he lay, and he gives a command, go and tell the disciples that this has happened. Go into Galilee, because everything is going to kick off in Galilee. So the woman's response in this first scene is very simple. They do as the angel said. Verse 8. So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and they ran to tell his disciples. There's a lot of movement in the resurrection story. There's a lot of action that goes on here. And these women, they hurry away, it says in verse 8, and they're running. There's an urgency about this. They're hurrying, they're running. But notice their mixture of emotions as they do this. It says they're afraid, yet they're filled with joy. Do you know those two emotions can exist together at the same time? The psalmist said in Psalm 2 that we're to serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. So in their fear, their sense of, we're not quite sure what's going on here, yet there was this incredible joy that Jesus was alive. Now, in their hurry and in their running of verse 8, something happens in verse 9. Suddenly, Jesus met them. That word suddenly can be translated, behold. And it's a favorite Bible word. If you should read the Bible, you'll come across this word again and again. Behold, behold. Matthew has used it 3 times already before we get to Matthew 28. He's used it as a word to grab our attention. Something amazing is going on. Stop, look, behold. So Matthew 1 verse 20, behold, an angel appeared to Joseph. Matthew 2 verse 1, behold, wise men came from the east. Matthew 3 verse 16, when Jesus was being baptized, behold, the heavens were opened. And now here, Jesus meets them. Behold, there is a risen Savior. Look, see, get a hold of this. It is amazing. Behold, he is alive. And then Jesus speaks. Verse 9. Greetings, he said. Greetings. You know, we've said before that this word greetings can be translated in different ways. And Bible translations translate this in different ways. The word, kareti, means be cheerful. That's the word. But some Bible translations have this word translated as rejoice. So the first words, these are the first words, remember, that Jesus says to these ladies. He's alive. The first words after his death in this passage are greetings, as the NIV puts it. So another translation has be glad. Another translation, rejoice. Another translation, seeking to be really contemporary, has good morning. That quite just doesn't fit, does it? Like the first words Jesus says when he's alive, good morning, everybody. That just doesn't seem to work. But it's more like, it's not just a greetings, it's a rejoice. That's what he's saying to them. Now, Jesus had a long time to think about his first words after his resurrection. What do you say after you've been raised from the dead? Rejoice! And that's what he says to these ladies. Rejoice. And at that point, after he said this in verse 9, they came to him, they clasped his feet, and they worshipped him. And then Jesus said to them, don't be afraid anymore. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, for there they will see me. This is what the risen Lord says to us today. Rejoice. Be glad. Death is defeated. I am risen from the dead. And the experience that these women had on that Easter Sunday morning is the experience of every disciple ever since. Their lives were changed. Their thinking was changed. Their experience was changed. Their outlook was changed. Their gloom on the way to the tomb had been turned into light and hope. Their fear was not now their only experience. They had fear. We read in verse 5, do not be afraid. They had fear. We read in verse 6 that they were still afraid, yet they were filled with joy. So they had fear and joy. By the time you get to the end of verse 10, it's don't be afraid anymore, just be filled with joy. And this is what happens when you come to trust the Lord Jesus Christ. There is joy in your life. A joy unspeakable and full of glory. It's so glorious you can't describe it. It's an inner joy based upon a historical fact. Jesus Christ appeared to these disciples and said, rejoice, I'm alive. Yes, even with the troubles maybe in your life, with that crisis that we spoke about earlier, with that fear and with that anxiety, yet don't be afraid, but be full of joy that someone has conquered your deepest fear, death. So scene one is full of light and full of truth and full of hope and full of joy. And then the music changes and the lights dim down and we come to scene two. And scene two is a dark and gloomy scene full of despair, the deceit of the soldiers. Here's verses 11 to 15. Let's read that. While the women were on their way to tell the disciples, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. They'd come to now. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, 'His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we'll satisfy him. We'll keep you out of trouble.'" And so the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. So these reawakened guards go to the Jewish authorities. They tell them what they've seen. They tell them about the empty tomb. And they tell them about this startling angel. And the Jewish authorities, these religious leaders, are frightened and unbelieving. And they say to these guards, "Make up this story. Tell everyone that you fell asleep and the disciples stole the body." And that's what they did. That's the story they told. Now, if you think about it, there's no way that this guard story can be true. They say the disciples stole the body. The disciples would never have done that. They were all chicken. They were in an upper room with the doors locked for fear of the Jews. They weren't even going to poke their head around the corner. They were there frightened. So the disciples would never be brave enough to overcome these Roman soldiers and steal the body. What's more, these Roman soldiers say, "We fell asleep." Roman guards never fell asleep on duty. If they did, it was the death sentence. And what's more, even if they did fall asleep, how did they know it was the disciples that stole the body? So it's quite a ridiculous story, and it's a lie. But it's amazing the length some people will go so as to avoid the truth, especially the truth of Jesus and his resurrection. In fact, it's easier to believe a lie, and it's more convenient to a lifestyle you want to choose to live. But it's a lie. It's a made-up story. What's behind it all? How come these Roman guards were convinced to say such a lie? Money. And if you see, it would have to take a lot of money to make them say this lie. So we see in verse 12 that they met with the elders and devised a plan. They gave the soldiers a large sum of money. And they said, "Well, we'll actually tell the governor if he hears about this." A large sum of money. So these Roman soldiers now are fairly rich because they've told a lie about an historical event. How happy were they? What happened when their money ran out? Or, if you think about it, what did they spend their money on? And how did they keep their consciences calm? You know, sin, lies, deceit, it does a strange thing to us inwardly. And for a while, we can press that down, we can suppress it, and we can keep our consciences calm. But not forever. There are things that come back to us that remind us of the lie, of the deceit, and we're unhappy. Wonder what these Roman soldiers thought every time they spent some of that money. "I know where this money come from. I got it for telling a lie." And what about living in fear that one day they'd be found out? Anyway, money convinced them, and money pulled the wool over their eyes. And money can do some horrible things. Or money can do some great things. But money can also do some awful things. And it was money that made these Roman soldiers spread a lie. That's the lie. That's the spread. And that was way back then, 2,000 years ago. So it's not the philosophers of the Enlightenment, nor the smart evolutionists, neither the mixed-up postmodernists who first denied the resurrection of Jesus. The first people to deny the resurrection of Jesus were religious leaders and Roman guards. And that was 2,000 years ago. There's nothing new under the sun, yet none of them have silenced the risen Christ. So if scene two is dark and gloomy because of the lie, and yet nothing can silence this gospel of Christ, then we are to expect light and hope and a true message in the final scene. So verses 16 to 20, the commission of Christ. If the guards were out spreading bad news and telling stuff about darkness, then the disciples are told to tell good news and to spread the light. Now the setting is in verse 16 of this final scene. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. The build-up to Galilee is immense. You just read Matthew's gospel and everything is heading towards Galilee. Why Galilee? Because Galilee is like the gateway to the nations. It's a new beginning in Galilee. Indeed, it's where it all began. In Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 to 17, those walking in darkness had seen a great light. And that applies to the beginning of the ministry of Jesus. And that all took place in Galilee. Quite a small area, really. And now they're going back to Galilee for this new beginning after the resurrection. So go back to Galilee, go back to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. It was a large gathering, says in verse 17, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Now this was probably bigger than the 11 disciples. This might refer to 500 people that the apostle Paul speaks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So amongst them, there were still those who doubted that resurrection. People say today that those first century people, they believed anything. They were so primitive, they would believe anything in those days. Well, they didn't, did they? Because even here, some were doubting. But eventually, Jesus convinced them. Some worshipped, some doubted. And what does Jesus say to them? In verses 18, 19, and 20, he gives them a claim, a charge, and there's a consequence. The claim is in verse 18, it's mammoth. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." He's claiming here ultimate power, all authority. It's not just I'm going to share this authority with someone or I've got a slice of the power. It's all authority in heaven and on earth. You can't get any more authority than that. In heaven and on earth, all of it, whatever authority there is given to me. He is claiming here to be the universal Lord, the sovereign King of all humankind, the King of kings and Lord of lords. There's an Old Testament psalm, Psalm 24, that says the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And that's what Jesus is claiming here. It's all mine. I have all authority. If his claim is not true, then he is such a liar. All authority has been given to me. And with that power and that authority, he then commissions his church. Verse 19, "Therefore, because all authority is mine, therefore you go, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." So this is what the disciples were to do. Go, make other disciples. What's a disciple? A disciple is someone who believes the same things as Jesus and behaves the same way as Jesus or tries to do so. And once somebody has said they believe in Jesus, baptize them to show they believe and then carry on teaching them because there's a lot of stuff to learn. So go make disciples, baptize and teach. Now notice this, the go word in the whole of this chapter. And Jesus says it here in verse 19, "Therefore go." But it's been mentioned a few times already. The angel said it to the women in verse 7. "Then go quickly and tell the disciples." And Jesus said it to the women in verse 10. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid, go and tell my brothers." And then it's repeated in verse 19, "Go and make disciples." We've got an idea of a thread coming through the whole of this chapter. It's go, go. First of all, the two goes, these were simply the go-go girls. But then, Would the third one go, go, go? It's quite clear. They've got to get on with it. You can't hang around. Go and make disciples. Don't mess around. Where's my phone? Where's the keys? Just get on with it. Don't hang around. Whatever the situation, get out. Make other disciples. You know, this is the church's responsibility to make disciples. Go. It's not come to us. Come to our building, come to our events, come on our terms, come to a place where we feel comfortable. But rather it is go to them. Go outside the four walls. Go where people are, whatever they are like, where you feel uncomfortable. Go and make disciples. And the church is not just to sit around worshipping, but they're to go and make disciples. You know, there's twice the word worship is mentioned in this chapter. In verse 9, suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Now, in that worship, what does Jesus say afterwards? Verse 10, go. So they were worshipping, and then Jesus says, go. And that kind of a pattern is repeated in verse 17. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But what does Jesus say then in verse 19? Go. So worship is for going. It's not just that the church has been called to meet for worship meetings. That's not the reason why the Lord Jesus has left the church on earth, just so that we can have worship meetings. It's great to have worship meetings, but heaven is going to be full of worship meetings. And no evangelism in heaven. But here, there's worship that should lead to evangelism. Up there, it's all glory, it's all heaven. I mean, you can only just sometimes speculate and guess what it's going to be like up there. And it's fun to do so at times. But we'll know the reality when we get there. But the Bible tells us various things that will happen in glory. And one is that we will worship. And we will adore, and we will sing praise to the risen Lamb. On Good Friday, I was walking home with my youngest daughter, 10 years old, and we were speaking about heaven. And she was just asking questions about it. And the first question was, will we need to sleep? And I said, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe we'll have a lot of energy. Maybe we'll be running all the time. She didn't like the idea of that too much. Being a girl at 10. then we went on just a little bit more because it's a 5-minute walk home. A little bit more. And I said, maybe we'll fly. Maybe we'll have wings. And her, being a 10-year-old fashion conscious girl, says, hope I can choose the colour of my wings. Maybe we won't even have wings. But whatever it will be like when we get there, it'll be worship, worship and adoration. But now it is worship to go. That's why we worship here. That's why we gather, in order to go. We gather to scatter. We're commissioned every Sunday to go back out to our front line with a message of joy and peace. And the urgency is clear. You see, while there were people spreading lies about Jesus, these Roman soldiers, then the disciples are told to go and spread the truth about Jesus. And there are many people around spreading lies about Jesus. There are so many distortions of Christianity around today. There are false religions around today. There's darkness, gloom, and hopelessness around today. And the lies do not hold out any hope or certainty for anyone. Imagine if you believed the guard's message. So the guards come to you and they say, Jesus is still dead somewhere in Jerusalem. And you'll say, oh, that's really good news. It doesn't do anything for you. If you believe a lie, eventually it will kill you. Lies do not give joy, peace, hope, and life. But the true message, the message of the angel, the message of the Son of God, the message of heaven, is peace, joy, life, and hope. Into this world of darkness, we can bring light. Into people's uncertainty, we can bring certainty. Into people's crazy, mixed-up lives, we can bring joy. And the consequence of it all is at the end of verse 20. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. He's always with us, wherever we go, because he's alive. So where is your hope this Easter time? And where does your joy come from this Easter time? And what is helping you in the midst of your crisis this Easter time? Matthew chapter 28 shows us that there is one man called Jesus who has conquered death. He's conquered death itself. He has overcome the grave. He lives forever. And he offers you hope, peace, and joy. Help in our troubles now and a satisfying life after death. Too good to be true? Is the ending too Disney-fied and happy ever after? Well then, believe the lie. See where it gets you. See how happy it makes you. See what it's like in the face of death when you believe the lie. But if Jesus is alive, if he is who he claimed to be, the resurrection and the life, then it is no great surprise to know that he who believes in me will live even though he dies. And there's the message of the angel. He is not here. He is risen. But then the message of Christ. I am here because I am risen. Well, let's sing our final song. Glory to Jesus, risen conquering Son. Endless is the victory over death you won.